Hello, everyone. I'm John Melke, and this is Parkside Today. It's a pleasure to welcome two UW Parkside faculty members, Dr. Natalia Taft, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences, and Dr. Christopher Noto, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences. Natalia and Christopher, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So before we dive too deeply into some of the research that each of you is involved with, let's talk a little bit about the 3D Morphometrics and Image Analysis Intense Winter Workshop, and I had to work just to say that and had to look it up. But I'll let each of you explain a little bit more about what the workshop was about and how each of you got involved in that.
Okay. Well, the winter workshop that we just attended was a National Science Foundation-sponsored workshop specifically on how to use shape analysis tools. And these are open-source tools. So the main one that we learned how to use was a program called SlicerMorph, which is an open-source software that is being developed by biologists and other scientists to analyze the shape of a lot of biological structures and try and help make the association between shape and function. So it has a lot of practical applications, not just for biology, but also in the medical field. And we had to apply to this program. It was a selective program that we applied to, and there were scientists from all around the country and the world, about 30 of us, that came together to learn how to use these tools. And it was great because it was all different stages of scientists, from grad students to postdocs to pre-tenure professors and tenured professors, teaching us how to use this software and other forms of what we call statistical shape analysis, which is basically the math behind analyzing shape.
And what's the advantage to using this? Does it give you a let's say, in my non-scientific term, like a clearer picture of things that you're looking at, or you're able to see a little bit more into what the particular, now I know, Chris, you work a lot with fossils, and Natalia, you're telling me that you're working more with the living organisms, correct?
Fish skeletons, primarily.
And so does it give you a better picture or view of the different things that you're looking at or you're researching and interested in?
We can look inside stuff, which is great.
Oh, well, that's pretty good look.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the question that you're interested in, but this idea of shape analysis has a very long history, going back about 30 years now. And it's gone through this pretty steady evolution from using relatively simple measurements, like linear measurements, you know, like you measure the length and the width and stuff like that, into graduating into more complex but still two-dimensional analyses. They would say use a photograph and place points on that photograph, and you have a variety of statistical methods for comparing the positions of those points, and that can allow you to address multiple questions and problems. Okay. But organisms are inherently complex, and we have three-dimensional shapes. And so what this software allows you to do is to take advantage of those three-dimensional shapes and has developed a series of tools that allow you to create a workflow which basically takes you from the raw data, the actual three-dimensional shape or model of a specimen, all the way to characterizing aspects of its shape and then being able to compare those collected data all within a single software environment, which is something that it really hasn't existed much before this.
Or a lot of the software has been proprietary and costs huge amounts of money. And what this program is really doing is trying to make an open source software that any scientist can use and get trained on and teach their students how to use and not have to spend, you know, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars to use the proprietary software. So this is a really amazing tool for the scientific community, and that's why they have National Science Foundation funding to help teach scientists how to use this, so that it brings the tools, you know, that are more, so that scientists like us can use it. But you know, we don't have access to some of the other software, so it's great. It's sort of a democratizing science kind of tool.
And how, when you say hasn't been around that long, what, give us a time frame of when did this, would this open source maybe first come to be available?
The software platform has been around oh gosh, at least 10 years.
Yeah, I think so.
They started developing it. Okay. And so it has a pretty long history, which was one of the reasons why the organizers of this workshop had chosen it as a platform to work on developing these specific tools within, because one of the problems with these software that is often a grant supported or supported by some amount of internal money at an institution is that it takes money and time to develop and support software. We all know this. If we've if you have a computer, you got to pay. You know, yeah. You got to pay for new versions of software and stuff like that.
Sure.
So it takes money, and there have been many programs that have been developed over the years that might have done similar things or tried to do the same things, but eventually the money runs out. Mm-hmm. They stop developing them, stop updating them and supporting them, and so they essentially, you know, may end up not working anymore as computers advance, right? Mm-hmm. As your operating system changes, all that. Mm-hmm. And so the SlicerMorph people saw the stability of this platform and the fact that it's used by such a wide community as a major benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have been working very actively to not only extend the capabilities of the software, but also bring it to the attention of scientists like ourselves who could find real use and benefits from using this, this software.
Yeah. So one of the cool things was that we were also helping them test the software. So we bring our really complex problems. So Chris brought a jaw from one of the fossil alligators that he described. It was really interested in looking at teeth, right? Mm-hmm. The sockets that the teeth were in. Mm-hmm. And I was bringing fish skeletons because I'm really interested in the individual bones that support the fins and how they vary. And I brought a weird fish that uses some of its fin rays to walk on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested in how those fin rays are different than other kinds of fish. And so I couldn't do these analyses without the software to look inside the fins.
Yeah.
And so we throw this new data, this new weird data that they've never seen before, and we get a chance to work with it, and they get a chance to test their program and these scientists really need this tool. Could we develop that? So they were actually developing tools on the ground that week when we were there, in specific response to our data, which was kind of a cool process to watch.
It was a lot of troubleshooting.
Now, had either of you worked with this particular platform before the workshop, or was that the first time?
I got started last semester. You got started before
I've
then.
I've been playing with it for many years off and on as it's evolved. So, I'm familiar.
What do you think have been some of the, when you say as it's evolved, what have been some of the improvements? Just usability or the variety of things you can do with it?
A lot of it is usability and stability.
Okay.
When I used to use it, it would crash often. So it's definitely a far cry from what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what's great is that it's getting stable enough now, and also the support is good enough now that I feel like I can teach it to my undergraduate students. Mm-hmm. I have a student working on a project right now, and there's enough tutorials online and enough support online that she taught herself how to use a bunch of this before I went to this workshop. She's amazing.
Wow.
Lizzie is my student, and she learned how to do a lot of really cool stuff. Visualize a structure on the, a 3D structure, turn it around, look inside it, take measurements. These are all things that their tutorials are, available.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a really good opportunity for us to actually sit down and go through a lot of the cool features because it would take a long time to do it on your own. And so just to have a week of intensive training with other scientists who are interested in morphology and shape.
And a lot of it too was just figuring out what the capabilities of the software are, because so much of it has been developed individuals or research groups have developed tools specific to their own needs.
Okay.
And unless you try and go through and figure out what each and every one of those does, you might not know if it is applicable to the sort of research questions that you have. And so one of the nice things about this workshop was that we had the opportunity, people are saying, oh, well, here, if you're interested in these things, these are the sorts of tools you can use. Here are examples of how you can use them.
Mm-hmm.
And here are some tutorials to
I already need to refer back to the tutorials. But they, you know, so I'm trying to think of a good example that I can talk to about how this is applied. And I think the most striking example to me was one of the lead researchers on the project. His mm-hmm. name is Murat Maga, and he is a researcher at Seattle Children's Hospital. And they have a lot of problems. So for example, they need to model. So human skulls are actually highly variable, for example. And there's a lot of variation in human skulls between males and females and you know, ages and just natural human variation.
Okay.
And so they had, they fed the data from 100 people into a model to get sort of a generalized human skull model. And then they had a person that had a big piece of their skull missing. I don't remember how this person had a big, but they used the generalized model of the skull. And then they fed this person's damaged skull, the data for the damaged skull, into the software. And then they could actually help the doctors build a special piece to fill in what was missing, but by modeling. Using the data from all these 100 skulls and then the data from this one damaged skull. And because what doctors usually do is just take the good half and, like, say half of the skull is missing. They take the good half and make a mirror image and then use that to fix it. But this, they could actually specifically tailor it to the side of the skull, and it was even better. So, I mean, it was a better match. And so that's the kind of power that you can get from using this statistical shape modeling and the shape software. Is you can help solve medical problems. If you have a child with a craniofacial deformity, you can take a CT scan of their skull. You can then look at it on the computer and see what is the problem, how are we going to fix it, and print out 3D models. So Chris has a 3D printer in his lab, and we have another one at Parkside. You could actually print out a model and, you know, practice with it, go in, open it up, see what the problem is, so doctors can practice with these 3D models that you can make with this software that, you know, we just didn't have access to before. So it's helping with medicine. It helps with outreach. You can print 3D models of my specimens or Chris's specimens and show them to people. You can make them bigger or smaller. Say you have a really tiny little skull. You can actually 3D print the same skull but bigger, so you could actually get a better look at it, you know, get a better sense of what's going on. So,
well, like there's a graduate student who's there at the workshop who works on termites, and she had brought termites to micro CT scan, and so what she could do conceivably is make a model of, like, say the head shapes of the different castes that make up the up a termite colony, and or from different species even, and blow those up and print them out at large size, so it would be very easy to show, say, a member of the public or someone what those differences are. And that can actually go a long way to helping people understand some more of maybe the complex results of some of this research, because it can be kind of esoteric when we talk about shape space and morphoclines that stuff can get bogged down in the details. But what we really are talking about at the end of the day is how the shape differs between different sets of objects or specimens. Yeah. And so you can actually build a set of either virtual or 3D printed models that can showcase those differences and help explain to people, you know, the major results or outcomes of a given set of research. And that's one of the main powers, especially of these 3D based methods, is because we have the technology and the capability of creating these very detailed models that can, you know, our brains and our eyes are still much better at seeing differences and understanding those differences intuitively than a computer is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so being able to model things this way can go a long way to helping communicate that and understand that.
And maybe this is an uninformed question, and if it is, I'll apologize right up front for that. But Chris or Natalia, give me an example of, let's say, Chris, in your work with, finding the different types of animals that you're discovering in the Arlington, Texas area, the fossils that you're discovering. How do you, are you taking a picture of it, or how are you getting that thing into the system that allows the software then to do what it does.
Sure.
If that makes any sense. I don't know if that makes sense for the question.
There are multiple ways now to generate a three-dimensional data for an object. Mm-hmm. So I use three primary methods. I use a CT, computed tomography, which is a CAT scan people might be familiar with if you go to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There are different versions of it now where there are really tiny machines, which are called micro CT, which basically allows you to do very, very high resolution scanning on very small objects.
Yeah, you get a lot of detail.
And then I also have a laser scanner, which creates an external model. So basically it's like making a three-dimensional picture of the outside of a model. So you don't know what's going on inside, unlike CT, which is basically x-rays.
Mm-hmm.
You can see inside of those objects. With a laser scanner, you can't. But you get a very nice model of the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another method called photogrammetry, which allows you to basically take a bunch of photographs, and you have software that's able to triangulate those photographs and create an object out of those photos.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So you have an object, you have cameras set up at different angles, and they can basically build a 3D multiple model of it. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Okay. So, and then there's a variety of different types of software that either, you know, you can use to generate these models or to turn them into a format which software like the Slicer Morph can read.
Yeah,
and then you can feed some of that data into a 3D printer, for example, and print out a model so someone can hold. Like if you have if you're interested in a mouse skull, you can. And they're small. You can make a big blow up and look inside. So,
I just want to interrupt for a second and let people know that we're talking with Dr. Natalia Taft and Dr. Christopher Noto, both of whom are associate professors of biological sciences here at UW Parkside. And we're talking about Slicer Morph. And I hope I got that right. Slicer Morph. And Slicer Morph, which is an open source software that allows scientists to use the powers of CT and radiology and that type of thing to better understand the different work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough?
Absolutely, that's good.
Mm-hmm. I'd like each of you to talk a little bit about the particular research that you're involved with. And whichever one of you would like to, Christopher is pointing at Natalia, if you could see, you're on the radio, you can't see him pointing. But Natalia, if you could talk about your research.
Sure. So I've always been interested in skeletons. Ever since I was young, I think my mom's an anthropologist, and I got really interested. We always had models of skulls around the house, and I got really interested in skeletons. I've always loved biology. Mm-hmm. And then when I started learning about skeletons, I got really interested in variation and how we can look at it, how a scientist can look at a bone and learn something about that organism, how it moves, how it eats, what it does. And that was fascinating to me. Mm. And I was really interested in those kinds of questions. And during the course of my graduate work, I got really interested in fish skeletons because they're actually pretty highly variable. So a lot of people think about fish in terms of dinner, right? Like perch or walleye or your standard kind of fishy fish.
Yep.
But I got really interested in fish that did weird things with their fins. So I'm really interested in fish that do things like crawl along the bottom with their fins, but they still have to use them to swim. How does a fish use a single fin to do multiple kinds of behaviors, to swim and to crawl and to climb or to even walk on land or do hopping for it.
Yeah.
So I got really fascinated by those kinds of fish and how the structure of their fin skeletons varies to allow them to do different things. So if you're interested in variation in skeletons like I am, fish are an excellent model because they do all kinds of weird stuff, right? There's like long fish and short fish and big fish and small fish and red fish and blue fish, whatever, all these different kinds of fish. And they do all kinds of different stuff. And so there's basically infinite possibilities for somebody like me who's interested in how skeletons vary through evolutionary time, ecology, how different fins do different things. So I can get a scan of a fish and look at a bunch of different things. I can look at the shape of their vertebrae. I can look at their fin skeletons. I can look at their jaws. So these are all the kinds of things. And what's great about it is the same technology we use to look at fish skeletons is what doctors use. And we have a really strong pre-health program here at Parkside. Mm-hmm. So what I'm doing is training my undergraduate students in techniques that they will conceivably use in their real world experiences, learning to look at these scans, learning to interpret data. How does morphology vary, you know? Like human skulls vary, human bone varies. How do fish bones vary? It's the same kind of questions. It's just different organisms. And I happen to be partial to fish. Mm-hmm. But there's so many applications for it. So that's why I think I'm excited to work with undergraduate students here at Parkside, because it gives them the opportunity to really practice these skills mm-hmm. that they're interested in and see if they're interested in doing research and mm-hmm. see if they're interested in this kind of thing. So it's really cool to give students the opportunity to look at these questions yeah. and to play with these tools that we all actually use as scientists.
And as you talked about earlier, the maybe we'll say the cost prohibitiveness, if that's a
yes.
word,
yes.
of some of the some other tools
software,
that allow
yeah.
you to, type of software that allow you to do that. And now here comes SlicerMorph that opens this up to a wider
Absolutely.
Audience of users.
Yeah, without SlicerMorph, we couldn't do this work with students here just because it's very, very expensive. And so this is a really excellent opportunity for us to use some cutting edge tools with our students.
Mm-hmm. One license for one of these more popular
like $30,000.
Yeah. Was it? It's like yeah, tens of thousands.
Yeah, $20,000 to $30,000 for some of these other proprietary software. It's
right.
it's just outside the scope of, and that only lasts for so long, and you have to re-up, and so this is a really good opportunity. So
yeah.
it's like virtual dissection. You can do a dissection on a computer. It's fantastic.
Wow.
And we do regular old dissections too, but using these tools is really cool. It's fun.
Wow. And Chris, tell us about some of your work and recently the another discovery in the Arlington area, and I'll be careful there because sometimes I don't know how much I can say or can't say depending
he knows,
on which
so
one
it's
it
fun.
Is. So I'm just going to leave it as
if you read it on the internet, then it's okay.
No. Oh, okay, yeah.
I have a lot of overlapping interests with Natalia, except my focus tends to be on extinct organisms, fossil organisms. My primary research now concerns understanding and describing a fossil ecosystem from around the Dallas-Fort Worth area of, mm-hmm. of Texas. There's a dig site that I've been working there for many years called the Arlington Archosaur Site. But my primary interest really is looking at how what ecosystems were like in the past and the organisms that made them up. And so that encompasses a really broad range of questions. But really it boils down to the fact that I'm interested in how similar or different ancient organisms were like from what's alive today.
Mm.
And I can use the programs like SlicerMorph to help visualize specimens, look inside of them. One of the things that I was doing at the workshop was looking at actually the shape and position of the tooth sockets in the little species of crocodile I described last year called Scolomastax,
mm-hmm.
which we talked about on the program
we did,
before.
Yeah. Yeah.
What that looked like, and I actually hadn't done that yet because we were too busy just trying to get the paper out the door. And that was really neat to be able to create a three-dimensional model of what those tooth sockets look like, because we don't have the teeth anymore, but we can look at the shape and positions of the tooth sockets to get some idea about the teeth that sat inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one example of something that I can do with this software. Other things I am interested in is the shape of claws, ungules that most animals, if you have a cat or a dog or if you have a bird, they all have claws
uh-huh.
on them
uh-huh.
And the shape of those varies a lot between different organisms and depending on what they do with their bodies and,
yeah.
and we can learn a lot about the ecology of extinct organisms by studying their claws, and so that's another thing that I'm interested in using this software to address, because they are complex and three-dimensional structures and could use a similar treatment to things
yeah.
like Natalia's.
I want to get back to you, Natalia, but mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to follow up a little bit, Chris, is in your work, and I know I've heard you talk in the past about, the ways in which, I guess for lack of a better term, one animal may attack another animal,
mm-hmm.
that you're able to see some of that in the fossils that
mm-hmm.
you're discovering. Does something like SlicerMorph give you even a more clear picture of what that might have been like, or why an animal may have been attacked or not?
Ooh, that's a good question. Right now, I'd say that's probably a little too broad for me to get at right now, because it really depends on the quality of and a number of fossils that you have.
Okay.
And so, based on my own work, we can characterize, say, the shape and the position of various, say, tooth marks and things like that. We can understand perhaps how the bones of the animal that was attacked were damaged or responded to a given, predator.
Sure.
That might give us some idea about clues as to the identity of the predator, for example. Some of what we can get out of this, it will depend on the fossils that we have access to.
Sure.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add, one of the great things we can do with these kind of analyses is you can look at what something that is extinct looked like and compare it to living things. Mm. So that's where I got a lot of what I do. And so I got really interested in what's called the water to land transition. So, all vertebrates, the fish were the first vertebrates. And at some point, some ancestor of vertebrates was a fish, but it was able to come out on land. Mm-hmm. And that transition from vertebrates in water to vertebrates on land was a really active area of research. So I worked on that for my postdoc with a really important fossil called Tiktaalik.
Okay.
And my specialty was the fin skeleton, and I just had that paper come out finally last January.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can compare the fin skeleton of something like Tiktaalik to other fishes that were only in the water, and then things that use their fins to go on the bottom, and use fish that use their fins to interact with the bottom, and you can start to get an idea of how did these fish move? What did they do? Could they come out on land? Could they not come out on land? So you can use it to make new hypotheses about really important evolutionary transitions, like the water to land transition. So,
wow.
You need this kind of tool to do that kind of work, to look inside the fin ray, to look at the shape, to see how things are used it. And sometimes with fossils, you only have the rocks.
Yeah.
So
do each of you, as not only research scientists here at UW-Parkside, but also teaching scientists here at UW-Parkside, do you think that software, things like SlicerMorph, does it make it more attractive possibly for a young person who maybe is interested in getting involved in the sciences, that here's a tool that allows it to be more... that they can see it happening, or, or they get a better picture, and that makes them more interested in actually pursuing it or not? Or too soon to tell?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, I'm a functional morphologist, which means that I study the structure and function and how they work together. I didn't know that existed before I did work as an undergraduate scientist at the American Museum of Natural History. I didn't know until I was an undergraduate what research was, that it was a possibility. I didn't even, I knew that I wanted to teach college students, but I didn't even know about all the different kinds of research experiences. So I think that giving our students exposure to really these cutting edge tools really helps students learn about things that they might not even know was possible. They might not even know you can go to grad school and be a scientist and do this kind of work. And so we try and give as many students the opportunity to do this as we can. It takes a lot of time, but I think that's one of the more exciting parts of our job as teacher scholars, is to do this work with undergraduate students. And you do a lot of this work with students.
So, a lot of students, when they're coming in, they may think that they have to do research that's somehow directly related to the future career that they're aiming for.
Okay.
So within the biological sciences, a lot of students are interested in going to medical school or some kind of similar professional program, track.
Mm-hmm.
So they think they have to do things that are only going to lead them in some sort of straight line direction there. And that's not necessarily true. One of the things that we focus on with our students is developing skills. And research skills are translatable across any, within any lab, any field that they may end up going into. And many of us through our careers have crossed over between different fields, scientific fields, as we've gone through our education. So, for example, my undergraduate degree is actually in geology, not in biology.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of research to that end, but the skills that I learned and what I learned about being a research scientist were applicable regardless of the particular field or subject.
So the process.
Yeah, the process. And then the tools, like, so Natalia mentioned being able to work with like CT image data, that is a huge development for the medical field, and they're being able to understand how where CT image data comes from, how to manipulate it, how to use it to answer even basic questions. It doesn't matter what software you're using, mm-hmm. or anything like that, but the familiarity with it and how it's used can really benefit a student. So you don't know that necessarily until you get involved and see what is possible.
So right.
One of the most exciting things for me, I think, is that I experienced as an undergrad, and I hope that I'm helping our students understand, is science is all about things we don't know. So in order to do science, you have to have a foundation of understanding of what we know. But the exciting thing is to understand that we don't have the answers to these questions. And what I try and do, and I think all of us are trying to do, is teach our students how to ask questions and how to get answers.
Yeah.
Because that's a skill that's going to translate across any kind of work that you're doing. Is, well, how do I formulate this question? I don't know the answer. How do I find out? You know, when I was an undergrad, I became the world expert in bat humeri. I studied the humerus of bats, which is the upper arm bone of bats. I'm still the world expert, I think, in the bat humerus. But that was something that I learned a lot of stuff that nobody else knew before. And so just really empowering students to not just say, okay, what do I need to know for the test? But like understanding scientific questions, and that there's so much we don't know, and there's ways to go about answering it. And that they can do it too, is really exciting. You go through a period of frustration, you know, I think when you sort of learning this, but it's really an exciting process and empowering.
And I think this is also plays into the fact that this is why undergraduate research is really complementary to the classroom education. There are things that you learn through doing the process yourself and working through it, that and applying things that you may have learned in your classes here, that that is just it's an experience that cannot necessarily be replicated strictly through in a classroom environment. These are things that kind of require that sort of hands-on approach that is really an important aspect of a student's education here. And so it's very important. There's also why we encourage students to get involved with research as early as possible. A lot of students think that they need to wait until, like, you know,
their juniors or seniors.
Right. Or they have taken some certain set of classes before they'd even be allowed to get in the lab. And that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I always appreciate your time. It's always an interesting discussion. I learn things, so that's a good thing. And I'm sure that that our listeners, we think there's listeners out there someplace, that they're learning things as well. We've been joined today by Dr. Natalia Taft, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences, and Dr. Christopher Noto, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences here at UW Parkside. Natalia and Chris, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Good to talk to you.
To hear past editions of Parkside Today, please visit uwp.edu/parksidetoday. Thanks for listening, everyone.